On November 2, 1917, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, which led to the founding of the State of Israel 31 years later, by which point Britain vehemently opposed what it helped create. How does one make sense out of 1917, and how does one make sense out of 1948? Britain was an improbable agent in the founding of the State of Israel. It was the first European country to charge Jews with ritual murder. It was the scene of one of the bloodiest anti-Semitic massacres in the Middle Ages, and it was the first to expel the Jews en masse in 1290. Jews had to wait until 1871 to achieve political emancipation, which was later than in other West European countries, while religious anti-Judaism and racial anti-Semitism persisted. Britain was generally on the periphery of Jewish life. Most English Jewish barons were anti-Zionists. There was no British representative at the first Zionist Congress in 1897, and the Jewish community was divided on Zionism. And yet, the Jewish-born Benjamin Disraeli, who was the head of the Conservative Party and twice Prime Minister, who had converted to Christianity at a young age, twice served as Prime Minister, although his Liberal Party opponents sometimes accused him of following a Jewish foreign policy. Sort of charge that I think remained in the 19th century. Britain absorbed tens of thousands of Jews fleeing Russian pogroms in the 1880s, and there was a growth in the 19th century of an evangelical movement that sought to restore Jews to the Holy Land, albeit because they thought it would lead to the Second Coming. So you have this mix in British in Britain history towards the Jews. Then Britain started a focus on a Jewish homeland in the early 1900s. There was a brief moment where there was a consideration of settling Jews in British East Africa, but that wasn't really that seriously considered, and it really started to focus on that more in World War I. And then support started to grow. And the reason why World War I was significant, because the Brits were fighting the Ottomans, who were allied with the Germans in the war, and the Brits were already starting to think already in early 1915, actually even as late as 1914, beginning of the war, was what do we do with the Ottomans once we defeat them? But support for Jewish homeland, although it was raised in late 1914 and early 1915, really started to be a focus of consideration in the government in 1917 among various officials for various religious, humanitarian, and historical considerations. But they're also motivated by strategic interests. They wanted to justify their military campaign to liberate Palestine, which had begun early in 1917. And moreover, imbued with an exaggerated sense of Jewish power, which the Zionists themselves, since Theodor Herzl, had encouraged, many British officials were convinced that a pro-Zionist declaration would bring them greater support for the Allied war effort in the newly allied United States and for the teetering and tottering Allied government in Russia. For that narrow purpose, the Balfour Declaration was a bust. By the time it was published in Russia on November 29th, Lenin had already entered Petrograd, and the new Bolshevik regime withdrew from its wartime alliance and the war. But the British were soon in a position to make good on their pledge, because on December 11, 1917, General Allenby took Jerusalem after a nine-month campaign. And I'd like to pivot a little on focusing on Winston Churchill as a means for understanding the swings in British policy with which he was usually at odds, and frankly as a way to more directly plug my book. Churchill, naturally philo-Semitic, was drawn to the romantic notion of Jewish restoration to their ancient homeland and advocated Jewish political entity in Palestine in 1908. But his early Zionism was tenuous, and in 1915 he suggested giving the Holy Land to Belgium, and said nothing amid the discussion, and then the issuance of the Balfour Declaration in 1917. After World War I, he became Secretary of Air and War at a time of demilitarization and acute economic trouble, and almost a frenzied rise in anti-Semitism that derived from the Bolshevik Revolution and the publication of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. For the first time, Churchill, and really the only time, he was wary of the Jewish role in the world. He opposed acquisition of the Palestine and Iraq mandates on the League of Nations because he thought they would drain dear resources, and he wanted to maintain the Ottoman Empire intact as a counter to the Bolshevik to Bolshevik Russia, which is his main strategic fixation, really. And really, that view really resonated with the Conservative Party, which was the biggest party at the time, even though Churchill was then a liberal, but he was already starting to think about moving on, or moving back, I should say, the Conservatives. Churchill became colonial secretary in the early 1921, the beginning, which meant he had to implement the Balfour Declaration, having really said nothing about it, even opposing the Palestine mandate. And at a time when Zionism was becoming very much politically toxic, he restlessly moved early on to structure a new Middle East, even though he knew little about it, and was guided by in his policy by his largely Arabist aides, such as Lawrence of Arabia, who really didn't know much about the region either. Shortly into his ministerial tenure, he supported his aides' proposals to do three main things of note. Number one, give 75% of mandated Palestine to an Arabian prince, Abdullah, who's the great-grandfather of the current king of Jordan, shockingly without even consulting the Zionists. Number two, create Western Palestine as a Jewish homeland. Three, install Faisal, Abdullah's brother, king of Iraq, without knowing or recalling whether Faisal was Sunni and Iraq was majority Shia. Churchill formalized these decisions in conferences in Cairo and then in Jerusalem in 1921. While in Palestine, he met Palestinian Arab leaders and saw Arab neighborhoods, and he became convinced that Arabs and Muslims were, in his view, intransigent, backward, and anti-British. And indeed, the Palestinian Arabs had supported the Ottomans in World War I. Churchill's view contrasted with many in Britain who had romanticized the nomadic Arab. His meetings with the Jews were very positive in Palestine, and he was especially moved in visiting Jewish settlements. Witnessing the vineyards and pioneers of Rishon LeZion, he exclaimed, "Nothing will stand in your way. You have changed desolate places to smiling orchards and initiated progress instead of stagnation." He came to view the Zionists as kindred spirits and collaborators in the great mission to civilize the world, which is really his preeminent concern and objective, and remained forever at heart a Zionist, although Zionism remained captive to larger interests of his, such as British strategic and imperial security. He saw secular benefit to the world, to a Jewish homeland, in a way that the evangelicals in the 19th century and earlier had seen religious gain. Churchill ensured continued Jewish immigration as colonial secretary in order to gradually change the demographic balance. Of course, Palestine was overwhelmingly Arab at this time, though he eventually deferred to his aides and the High Commissioner Herbert Samuel and agreed to restrict immigration to some ambiguous economic capacity of the country, an issue that would come up frequently in the subsequent 25 years. In mid-1922, the House of Lords voted 2-1 against the Balfour Declaration, despite Balfour's own powerful speech in defense. However, Churchill won over the House of Commons with a strong speech in defense of the government's policy and of a Palestine hydroelectrification concession championed by the Russian-born Jew Pinchas Rutenberg. He gave a flavor in his speech of the mood in Parliament at the time when he cracked, "When you have Jews, Russians, Bolshevism, Zionism, electrical monopoly, government concessions, all presented at the same moment, it must be admitted all those ingredients are present, out of which our most inexperienced scribe or cartoonist or our most recently budding statesman might make a very nice case." In his last monthly report in Churchill's colonial tenure in October 1922, High Commissioner Herbert Samuel wrote Churchill with these striking words, "The country is quiet." Overall, it was a pretty good tenure for Churchill. Skipping ahead to the 1930s, Churchill became more pro-Zionist as England became more anti-Zionist. Arab-Jew violence in Palestine picked up in 1929 and fluctuated with greater intensity over the years. In response, the government always convened investigative commissions that made recommendations and was generally focused on the mandate administration reducing tensions with the majority Palestinian Arab population. Bassfield White Paper of 1930 sought to suspend Jewish immigration before it was reversed due to an outcry, which only radicalized both the Arabs and the Jews. The Peel Commission report of 1937 recommended partition, And most Zionists accepted, but the Palestinian Arabs and even many British Gentile Zionists, including Churchill, actually rejected the Peel Commission. That then followed with under Neville Chamberlain's government with the Woodhead Commission. Then there was a conference, a Middle East conference in London. It was the first time since really World War I that the British government took a more pan-Arab approach to the Palestine question. And it didn't go very well. The Arabs and the Jews weren't even, the Arabs refused to sit in the same room as the Jews. Then there was a 1939 white paper, which set a 5-year cap on Jewish immigration and essentially sought to terminate any chance of a Jewish homeland. Churchill took a very different view of the 1930s than most of his colleagues. He became most concerned with rising Nazi threat in Europe, growing Italian interest in the Mediterranean, loosening control over imperial possessions, and an image of British weakness. He was also viscerally repulsed by Nazism and its persecution of the Jews. This led him to a different set of approaches to Palestine. One, he saw the Palestine experience in acute civilizational, humanitarian, and even strategic terms. He argued for British steadfastness in maintaining the Palestine mandate. He saw appeasement of the Arabs just like he saw appeasement of the Nazis. He led the charge against the 1939 white paper, unsuccessfully, but somewhat effectively. And finally, he developed a personal bond with the Jews and Zionists who shared his besieged and isolated fate in the British wilderness. When he was prime minister in 1940, although he did not speak about Zionism in public or seek to overturn the 1939 white paper, he privately encouraged his colleagues to allow more Jews into Palestine, aspired to arm the Palestinian Jews so they could defend themselves against the Arabs, and eschewed any semblance of balance in his treatment of the Palestinian Jews and Arabs. He vigorously battled anti-Zionists, and when he considered anti-Semitic British ministers, military officials, and civilian officials over Zionism, relishing a conflict with an establishment that never really accepted him. He felt vindicated about his view of Zionism, just as he felt vindicated about his view in the 1930s with the Nazi threat. He sometimes felt compelled to remind ministers and officials that victory in war was more important than anti-Zionism. I'll give one quick example. For instance, when he was Lord of the Admiralty at the beginning of the war, the war cabinet had considered issuing instructions to the U.S., the British ambassador in Washington, saying that Britain would not whittle down the 39 white paper to appease American Jews and therefore gain more American, in their view, more American support for the war. So Churchill wrote scathingly to the war cabinet. There's a vintage Churchill line. The one thing he, the ambassador, ought not to say is that with the world in flux and the life of every European nation and the British Empire hanging in the balance, the sole fixed, immutable, inexorable fact was that that Jewish immigration to Palestine would come to an end after 5 years in accordance with the white paper. He also doggedly and passionately worked to fashion a post-war regional settlement that included a Zionist state, which he was prepared to impose on the Palestinian Arabs by force if necessary. He eventually achieved tentative war cabinet support for such a plan in early 1944 that entailed a Jewish state within a broader Middle Eastern association or federation. This effectively marked the repudiation of the government's prior policy guided by the 1939 white paper. He failed partly because of Franklin Roosevelt's equivocation, rising unpopularity of Zionism in England, and Ibn Saud's opposition. I'm happy to explain in questions anyone's interested in what that means. He was very frustrated after all this, after all the effort he put in into settling the Palestine issue, and left office never committing publicly to establishing a Jewish state. He left Chaim Weizmann high and dry. When he left Potsdam in the middle of the conference after the British electoral turns came in, one aide asked whether he wanted to give the newly elected prime minister, socialist leader Clement Attlee, some internal government papers on Palestine policy. Churchill replied, "I will keep them. They have no interest." Indeed, Attlee came to power in 1945, not only intent on pursuing a radical new foreign policy and imperial policy for Britain, but also broke with his own Labour Party's repeated promises to the Zionists, including the 1944 resolution, quote, "Let the Arabs be encouraged to move in as the Jews move Let the Arabs be encouraged to move out as the Jews move in. Attlee and his aggressive foreign secretary, Ernest Bevin, really reverted to the Chamberlain-Halifax policy in the Middle East. They downplayed European Jewish suffering. They closed off Palestine indefinitely to Jewish immigration. They appeased Arab peoples. They encouraged Transjordan to take over really much of Palestine. They opposed the Zionist state. And in line with the military's thinking, they sought to maintain control over Palestine as a strategic asset. Bevin had spoken of getting closer to the people and not the pashas. But in fact, he vehemently opposed the one democratic government in the region, Israel, which was also socialist to boot, just like he was. He used to be a head of the trade unions. While he supported many kings, Arab kings, princes, and pashas, Churchill publicly suggested Bevin was driven by anti-Semitism. For the first crucial years after the war, Churchill, now head of the political opposition, remained detached from the increasingly intense international diplomatic activity and violence on the ground in Palestine for various psychological, strategic, and political reasons, for which he felt ultimately very guilty. He called the situation, quote, a hell disaster. But in 1949, after Israel's War of Independence, Churchill expressed shock that Bevin dismissively compared the lack of diplomatic relations with Israel to a lack of relations with Indonesia, a land Churchill considered relatively insignificant. Churchill declared in Parliament, "The coming into being of a Jewish state in Palestine is an event in world history to be viewed in the perspective not of a generation or a century, but in the perspective of 1,000, 2,000, or even 3,000 years." Thanks.